Good afternoon and welcome to the Eco News Report. My name is Beth Werner and I'm the Executive Director of Humboldt Baykeeper, and I'm your host today for the Eco News Report. The Eco News Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU, brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, the Eco News. Don't forget you can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page at khsu.org. Today, my guest is Dr. Deborah Tillinger, and this is a very important show for me because Dr. Tillinger is not only an accomplished scientist, but is a very dear friend of mine. Dr. Tillinger has a BA in environmental science from Barnard and a PhD in ocean and climate physics from Columbia University, where she studied ocean circulation, specifically the Indian through flow. And if you don't know what that is, she's going to give us a lot of good explanation about her work, what she did there, what she's learned, and some takeaways that we can then think about as far as climate change goes, ocean circulation, and then the availability of science to the people. Well, welcome, Deborah.
Thanks, Beth.
How are you doing over there? Deborah's talking to us from New York.
New York is good. It's sunny out.
Yep, not too hot?
Not yet, no.
Well, that's good. So I did a little introduction about the Indonesian through flow, and, you know, can you just... A lot of people don't know what that is. So can we just maybe basically take a step back and talk about what that is and how you got into what you're doing?
Sure. That's the research that I did for my master's and my PhD. You can think of the whole ocean as one object, right? We usually separate it into the different oceans, but really those are just lines on a map. The whole world ocean is connected. So if you looked at a piece of water that was just off of my coast here in New York, eventually it would make its way over to you in California. And that's the overturning circulation of the ocean, where we try to track where the water is going. Some parts of it are pretty well understood. Things like the Gulf Stream are pretty commonly understood. A harder part is where the water returns from the Pacific Ocean to the Indian Ocean. The reason it's so difficult, a couple of things. It goes through Indonesia. So it's a series of little streams between islands. It's not one open passage. Also, that part of the world is influenced by El Nino and also by the Asian monsoon.
So this is a pretty unique area to study. Did you come about this through your own personal interest, or was there an opportunity to study that through with a professor, or how did that come to being?
Well, when I was an undergraduate, I took my first climate class as a freshman. And for whatever reason, I thought it was going to be about clouds. And it wasn't. It was fabulous. It was actually the first difficult class I'd ever taken. It wasn't difficult because the teacher was trying to make it difficult. Just the subject matter was actually difficult. And it was studying how the world works. And I pretty much fell in love. And that summer, the professor hired me to work in her lab. And I wasn't working on Indonesian through-flow yet, but I started working on ocean circulation then. After I studied at the Biosphere in Arizona, I decided I wanted to go to graduate school for climate. But since climate programs were then still pretty new, it was either oceanography or atmospheric science, and the oceanographers get to travel.
Well, there you go. Well, you did mention the Biosphere, and that was where Deborah and I had a chance to meet. Can you give us a little bit of background just about, you know, when people hear Biosphere, they may not know what you're referring to?
So if you've seen the very bad Pauly Shore movie Biodome, it looks just like that, although that movie was in fact not filmed on site. And the biosphere existed for the purpose of seeing, could human beings live in a closed environment? The point was maybe to see if someday we could live on another planet. The experiment itself didn't go all that well. There were lots of problems. Most of them weren't with the science. They had to do with the people, which may, in fact, be the most instructive lessons in the biosphere. But later on, Columbia University started an academic program there. And it was a whole semester of just doing science. And it was blissful.
It was blissful, that's for sure. And so just after you studied at the biosphere and then you had an opportunity to go back to New York and continue your studies, you decided to focus on the Indonesian through flow. And you mentioned its relationship to El Nino. How does that work? What are their relationships there?
So to start with, El Nino is just an unusual climate pattern that happens about half the time we're in a normal state and about half the time we're in an extreme warm or cold state, El Nino or La Nina. it's blamed for a lot of weird weather around the world. Some of that is accurate. Some of that is sort of an exaggeration. People start to blame El Nino for bad hair days. It does not cause that. But rain in Hawaii, mudslides in Indonesia, drought in southwestern United States, all of that can be attributed to the El Nino state of the ocean. All it is a question of where the energy in the ocean is. Is all the heat concentrated really far west, or is it more spread out along the middle? And that concentration of heat gives energy to the water in the western Pacific, and that's the water that feeds the Indonesian through flow.
So just to maybe take a little step back as well, so how does it get extra heated? Is that the process of circulation? Is that what's that process?
So the normal situation in the Pacific Ocean isn't a situation where everything is nice and even. Because of the direction that the Earth turns and because of the way that the winds blow, water is normally piled up in the west. So you can think about a puddle of water just sitting out there. It's going to get warmer and warmer. Whereas on the eastern side, there's cold water coming up from underneath. So you have cold water on one side, warm water on the other side, and that's actually normal to have that imbalance. What's unusual is when the winds fail and that warm water goes sloshing back across the Pacific Ocean.
That was a really excellent description. Good job. It's hard to make something like that easy to understand, and you're definitely good at that. Of course. I wanted to talk a little bit about what you have done so far with your research. You've been on 6, is that correct, cruises from anywhere from the Antarctic, the Philippines, the Indian Ocean, and the Pacific. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Can you tell? Okay, so you've been to Antarctica, and that's something that very few people can say. So what took you there, and what'd you do there, and what'd you think?
Well, I went to Antarctica, you could say, the long way. I started going to sea just because my advisor, Dr. Arnold Gordon at Lamont Doherty, would not allow any of his students to stay on dry land. He felt that if you're going to be an oceanographer, you need to have some experience with the ocean. There are actually a lot of oceanographers nowadays who just work on computers and have never been on a boat. So I was put to work measuring ocean velocity on a trip from Hawaii to Alaska. This had nothing to do with my own research, although it contributed to many other people's, but that's when I discovered that I loved going to sea. And once I had developed some skills that are useful at sea, specifically being able to measure ocean velocity with equipment that doesn't always work, I found myself going on more and more trips. And the trip to Antarctica was really a last-minute thing. I was working in a public school one day a week doing community outreach, and they really liked the idea of my being able to go on this trip and sharing the experience with my students.
So what kind of equipment were you using?
So in Antarctica, I was on the Nathaniel B. Palmer, and she's a really great ship for doing this kind of work. I do ocean acoustics to get velocity. So you don't necessarily connect those two things in your mind, right? How fast something is going and what sound it makes. But in the ocean, we can't use light because light doesn't penetrate very deep. We can't use radio waves. All of the normal ways we like to measure things aren't going to work in the ocean. But sound travels beautifully and clearly through the ocean. So I send down a machine called an LADCP that sends out just a little ping. And when that sound hits a particle in the water, that ping comes back to my machine and it listens for how long it takes to come back. The really important bit is the change in pitch called the Doppler effect. If you come to New York and you're waiting for a train, you can hear when a train's whistle is coming towards you or away from you, there's a difference in the pitch. And all my machine does is hear that difference and translate it into sound.
And so you would essentially create these pings, measure how long of the duration it was until it refracted back to your machine, and then you collect that data and understand the velocity of the water?
More or less. The processing takes a while, but all we're doing is taking each individual ping, looking at the Doppler shift, so whether the thing was moving towards or away from the machine, and the amount of time it took to come back. If you have pings going out in 4 different directions, you can get a 3D picture of what's going on in the ocean. It's really wonderful. Sometimes the surface will be completely smooth, no waves, no water moving. You send the machine down a little bit, and all of a sudden you can see that there's velocity below the surface. Sometimes very close to the seafloor, you'll get really strong currents.
So that's interesting. What kind of depths were you testing your instruments at?
The deepest I ever sent anything was 6,000 meters.
Well, that's pretty deep.
Which I remember because it's the factory rating for the machine, how deep you can send it. More common would be around 4,000 meters. That's the average depth of the ocean. In Antarctica, it was often shallower because we were on the shelves, so maybe 1,000 or 2,000 meters.
So give us a little bit about the human perspective of what you were seeing when you were on these massive research vessels.
It varied a lot by where I was. My first research cruise was from Hawaii to Alaska, and I was just struck by how far away we were from anything. I live in New York City. I've lived outside of it for a short period of time when I lived in the desert, but I have never at any other time been that far away from the rest of humanity. We were out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. We were hundreds of miles from any civilization.
So you kind of were on your own little biosphere there.
In a way, it works as its own little biosphere. I learned a lot of skills that I hadn't expected to learn. For example, my alarm clock broke. And at home, I would have thrown it out. It was a cheap travel alarm clock and bought a new one. But there was nowhere to buy a new one. And I needed to be able to wake up the same time every day in a room without windows. So I got out a soldering iron and I fixed my $5 travel alarm clock.
That's very resourceful of you. And makes sense, too, though. So what kind of crews were on these boats? Did you have a lot of people like yourself who were researchers, or were there a lot of people who were there to help out and kind of learn, or what was the crew like?
It's generally something like a 50-50 divide between science and crew. Science can be graduate students and up. We occasionally take undergraduates. On my first research cruise, I had the very odd position of being a graduate student on my very first cruise, but actually in charge of a project on the ship. That's because the person who was supposed to go had to stay home because his wife had a baby. So I ended up being there in his stead, and I was supposed to run a program that I really knew nothing about. But usually you get a mix of people who go to sea all the time and scientists who only go to sea when necessary to get their own data.
Well, if you're just tuning in, my name is Beth Werner. I'm the executive director of Humboldt Bay Keeper, and our guest today on the Eco News Report is Dr. Deborah Tillinger, and she's talking about her experience on a research vessel in Antarctica and her PhD thesis. And we are talking about her experience on the boat. So, I mean, a lot of people, when they think Antarctica, they think of, you know, kind of the romantic view of these penguins and polar bears and
no,
magical...
don't say that!
Well, let's hear it. What do you got?
Most important message I can give anyone is that there are no polar bears in Antarctica.
Huh?
Polar bears live in the Arctic. Penguins live in Antarctica. Okay. The only thing those two places have in common is that they are cold.
Well, Deborah, thank you. I did not know. Well, there you go. So you saw the penguins, though, I should assume.
I saw the penguins. They really are that adorable, but they smell just terrible. And they're really stupid.
Oh, okay. Well, did you got a chance to get off the boat then and look at the penguins or what?
I did. I had a few chances to get off the boat. And actually, before you go to Antarctica, you have to sign a lot of things. And one of those things says that you will not in any way annoy the wildlife, not approach them, not take anything. So when I was on land for the first time, trudging along behind a geologist trying to collect rock samples, I was careful to avoid the penguins, but they made no effort to avoid me. They are fearless, and they will walk right up to you, and you can trip over them.
Did you trip over any penguins?
I did not, but I slipped on some of the guano.
Happens to the best of us.
I don't think I can define guano on the radio.
No, we know what it means. So some of your tests, you did the acoustic testing, as you said. What other kind of tests were going on? You said 50-50 researchers crew. What other tests were going on? I remember you said something about vegetation samples.
Well, in Antarctica especially, we had people measuring just about everything you can in the water column. So in addition to velocity, I was running the computer for the machine that goes into the water that does everyone's sampling. So we measure salinity, temperature, and pressure in real time. So it always feels a little bit like watching election results come in, because I'm sitting there in front of a computer and all I can do is watch what's going on. And everyone's around me shouting out things that they see, things that they don't see, things that they'd like. And we're trying to get water samples that will be enough for everyone's research. But the way it usually is that there are more people who want water that I can get in our bottles. So it can be a little bit crazy. There's a bit of a sampling frenzy as soon as the thing comes back on deck. Some of the measurements require that you take the water sample immediately so it is not exposed to oxygen. So we measure fluorescence, we measure oxygen content, nutrient content, and we also usually have people to study the biology.
Well, it sounds like an absolutely amazing experience. What kind of results did you find from your tests?
Well, the research cruise in Antarctica was in some ways the least successful that I've ever been on. We got stuck in the ice. And it was very strange for many of us. We were stuck in the ice in the same place that Ernest Shackleton, the great Antarctic explorer, had been stuck. And while we complained about how sad it was not to have good flying weather for our helicopters, we all remembered that when he was stuck in the same place, they had no food and all nearly died. So our situation was not quite as dire.
And you were saying the boats, you know, big metal boat, big wood boat.
Yeah, they had a wooden boat, we had a metal boat, so we weren't worried for our safety. We were, however, worried for our science because we were stuck in the ice and we had a run of bad weather, which meant that our helicopters couldn't go out. Even though you might sometimes see helicopters flying in bad weather, they can't do that in Antarctica because we have no air traffic control. So our pilots, who are some of the best in the world, have to rely only on their eyes. And so if they can't see what's going on, they can't fly.
Being stuck doesn't sound like fun, but it sounds like, I mean, obviously everything worked out okay.
Yeah, well, everything worked out okay in the sense that we all did make it home. There was some research that we wanted to get done that we didn't get done. Some of that hopefully will be done next Antarctic season. But I did put out some moorings. So that means that we put out instrumentation that's going to sit on the ocean floor until we come back and get it. And that's really wonderful because it can sit there and record information while we're at home.
Well, it sounds like such a wonderful adventure, something that very few people get to do, so it's very exciting.
It was a lot of fun, but it's a long time to be away from home.
Well, certainly. So now that you're back in New York and you've had these experiences under your belt, what are you doing with that? How are you, I mean, it's one thing to do science and, you know, become a researcher and learn about all these wonderful things. But, you know, you and I have talked at length how important it is to take science outside of the lab and bring it to the people. And is there any way that you've found that you can do that?
I spend as much time as I can doing that. I work as a professor, so I do what we consider formal classroom science education. But I also do a lot of informal science education. When I do that, I perform as Dr. Mermaid, my alter ego. A friend of mine has a strong interest in mermaids, and she's a singer, and she sings about mermaids. And I remember thinking to myself that mermaids would make really good physical oceanographers. I send my equipment down much deeper than a human being could ever dive. But mermaids could go to any depth. And part of my job is to see things with instrumentation that a human being can't see. You can't see the temperature of the water. You can't see how fast it's going. But since mermaids are imaginary, I imagine that they can see those things. And a lot of people are drawn to the idea of learning about the ocean because it's fun and romantic instead of feeling like they're in class and if they don't understand everything, they'll get a bad grade.
Well, you said you taught at a public school. Did you have an opportunity, and you're currently a professor now, are you communicating any of your research to a in this Dr. Mermaid persona that takes some of the science and makes it easy to comprehend? Is that your goal?
That is my goal. I mostly don't aim my work towards children. I like working with children, great stuff with children, but my experience is that science museums are very much designed for children, and many science events, even here in New York City, are designed for children. If you think about it, it's somewhat absurd. Art museums tolerate children. Science museums are for children. So on some level, we're saying that science is a thing that kids do. I think we should take the other route and tell children that unless they behave really well, we're not going to let them do science. That science is fun and awesome and for grown-ups. And, you know, they have to be really, really good before we'd allow them to look in that world.
Well, I think that's a really great way to look at it. I think, you know, some people are intimidated by science, and it's so fun and interesting. And when you're young, you're really encouraged to explore the unknown. And as you get older, it's for people with degrees, and that's just nonsense. So I think what you're doing is really interesting. And I think taking it out of, as I said, out of the lab and into people's, you know, everyday knowledge is really important.
Thanks. I don't actually want to discourage children from learning science. I think it's wonderful when they do. But I find that adults are really underserved as a science audience. So when I perform as Dr. Mermaid, I've discovered that people who wouldn't otherwise go to a science show are willing to sit there and listen. And afterwards, they come up to me and they say, you know, I never knew that. I never understood these things about how the world works. And I feel that it's your world.
Yeah. We're on a radio show, and unfortunately, we cannot watch you perform as Dr. Mermaid. But can you give us a little bit of a taste of what that would look like or what that would be?
Well, first of all, if you are in New York tonight, Thursday night at 9 o'clock, I'm giving a talk at Marina 59, the Botel in Queens. Also, if you're in New York, we have the upcoming Mermaid Lagoon, where I will be on stage as Dr. Mermaid, and that's July 19th. But one of the many things I did as Dr. Mermaid was to actually dance my PhD. You heard me explain about how the Indonesian through flow works. And I think that radio is a great medium for communication. But so is dance. And so if you go to my website, deborahtillinger.com, you can actually see my PhD dance. I unfortunately did not win the Dance Your PhD competition, but I feel pretty wonderful about the experience.
Well, being someone who's seen it, you would have won if I was a judge. And that's Deborah Tillinger, deborahtillinger.com. And you've talked a little bit about Mermaid Lagoon, and I did a little research and I found that last year's Mermaid Lagoon benefit was for the Waterkeeper Alliance in the Gulf Coast.
Which is
obviously close to our heart at Humboldt Baykeeper. What kind of, with your background, what kind of opinions, I know your opinions actually, but with the Gulf Coast issue, being an oceanographer, can you give us your take on that situation?
Sure. So the first Mermaid Lagoon and last year's were both fundraisers for the Gulf Coast, although the idea was actually in process before the BP oil spill. And for last year's talk, I really researched what actually happened on the drill rig. I've spent enough time at sea that I feel comfortable reading over logs and understanding that, you know, what goes on at sea is a little bit different than what happens on land. And the conclusion that I came to was that this was a series of human errors. The transcripts from the depositions read like a murder mystery or some sort of scary adventure novel. It was a series of bad decisions. No one person made one very bad decision, but a bunch of people made not so good decisions. And this was completely preventable. We got lucky, though. Because of the way the currents were going, the oil did not spread as far as it otherwise would have.
Can you go into details about how it did spread?
Sure. So the main currents going on there, there's a loop current within the Gulf, and that feeds into the Gulf Stream that I mentioned earlier. So what could have happened was that oil could have been brought straight from the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf Stream, which would have brought it along the east coast of the United States. Instead, that loop current kept it a little bit more contained within the Gulf. That made the cleanup much, much easier.
Well, that's an interesting take, being able to read those logs. And you are right. There are different ways, you know, on land versus on sea, how you do things. But it was absolutely tragic, as we all know. And it's wonderful that you've been contributing to helping them clean that up. Those efforts are much needed.
Thank you.
Well, as far as next steps, Deborah, what do you see as far as teaching and as far as, I know you have your event this evening. Can you say where it is one more time?
Marina 59, the Botel in Queens. It's almost on the beach.
Yeah. Oh, that'll be wonderful. Any of our listeners are either in New York or on their way to New York, please be sure to stop by. It's going to be quite the event. But as we have to wrap it up here soon, are there any next steps that you see as far as this science or in your involvement and expectations?
I'm really interested in pushing this agenda of informal science education. I've gotten some pushback from people who have told me that what I'm doing is making science not serious. And I agree, I'm making science not serious, but I'm also making people listen. So I'm working on a project right now involving butterfly conservation, and the story is being told as a fairy tale. But at the same time, it's going to contain real scientific information. We have the upcoming Mermaid Lagoon, and yes, it's a night of performance and dance. We have aerialists, but we're also raising money for a good cause, and there'll be actual education. And hopefully this winter, I'll be able to bring Dr. Mermaid back to where she began, which is actually Antarctica. We're hoping to do an Antarctica-themed event this winter for World Antarctica Day.
World Antarctica Day, when is that?
I do not remember.
Well, we'll be sure to pay attention at Baykeeper. We'll let everybody know. That sounds really interesting. Well, Deborah, we're about to wrap it up, and I just want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us, and we really appreciate all that you've done to grow science in the studies that you're doing, the climate science in the ocean, and just all of the very interesting projects you have in front of you. We're very excited, and Deborah is getting married soon, so very excited for her for that as well.
Thanks, Beth.
Of course. Well, this Saturday, the Trinidad will be having their Trinidad Fish Fest from 10 to 4. And after that, you can go over to the new Aquatic Center's dock, and they're having an event down in Eureka. So stay tuned Saturday, the 23rd, for all that's going on here in the North Coast. If you are lucky enough to catch us, this is the Eco News Report. My name is Beth Werner, and I've been your host for the past half hour. My guest today has been Dr. Deborah Tillinger, an ocean and climate physicist from New York. She has a website if you'd like to learn more. It's deborahtillinger.com. That's deborahtillinger.com. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the public affairs page at KHSU website at khsu.org, where these programs are archived for 2 weeks after they air. Previous shows are posted at the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. That's yournec.org. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call KHSU's listener comment line at 826-6089. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks to Fred McLaughlin for engineering. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU for the Eco News Report.